Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an Associate Director with the Federal Society's Practice Groups. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers and not of the Federal Society. Today's program is titled Clearing the Air, Recent Trump Administration Reforms to Environmental Criminal Enforcement. Today's moderator is John Irving, partner at Cecil Law. If our audience has any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen and not the chat, so we'll be able to access them later in the webinar. With that note, I will turn things over to our speakers to start the conversation. John, thank you so much for joining us and for moderating today's discussion.
Hi. Thanks, Libby. I appreciate it. My name is John Irving. I'll just go ahead and jump in with a description of today's event. With the growth of the administrative state over the last half century, an equal expansion has occurred in the number of actions committable by individual citizens that could be prosecuted as crimes. At President Trump's direction, the U.S. Department of Justice has initiated a new round of reforms aimed at ending over-criminalization of the nation's complex web of regulatory laws and standards. Most recently, DOJ announced that it was exercising enforcement discretion to dismiss several Biden-era prosecutions of individuals charged with violating the Clean Air Act, who were alleged to have tampered with emissions-related diagnostic systems on cars and trucks. Supporters of the Biden-era policies and critics of this new policy argue that such emissions controls deliver considerable benefits to the owner in the form of better fuel efficiency and to society in the form of cleaner air, and that this is a step backward in environmental enforcement. This panel will discuss DOJ's traditional approaches to criminal enforcement of administrative laws and regulations and offer viewpoints on recent reforms and changes to criminal enforcement in the current administration. Our discussion will focus in particular on the department's decision to end criminal prosecutions of individuals for vehicle tampering cases under the Clean Air Act. So again, my name is John Irving. I'll be moderating today's discussion. I'm a partner at a law firm called Cecil Law. I'm a white collar government investigations attorney with both government and private sector experience. And today, with us today are Grant Nakayama and Justin Savage, both of whom practice extensively in this area of the law. Grant is a partner at King & Spalding. He's also the head of that firm's Government Matters and Regulation Practice Group. Grant was formerly the Assistant Administrator for the Office of Enforcement and Compliance Assurance, or OECA, at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Justin is a partner with Sidley Austin's Washington, D.C. office, where he co-leads the Environmental Health and Safety team there. So I thought I would just start off by giving both Grant and Justin an opportunity to kind of give their perspective on the current state of things at DOJ and EPA. Grant, would you please start us off?
Thanks, John, and appreciate the opportunity to speak about this topic, which I think is very timely and is very important. And what I'd like to do is talk a little bit and provide some historical context and really talk about whether, there is this reform going on with respect to criminal enforcement in the environmental arena and, what that means historically, where that fits, because I think it is evident that there's a clearly reform going on. The new team, both at EPA and the Department of Justice, are, I think, pretty clear with respect to that drive to really reform the environmental enforcement process in writ large, but also the environmental criminal enforcement process. And I think Justin is going to have some nice slides that discuss the recent policy documents, and those policy documents have clearly signaled this new direction. So if you go back, let's think about a few background points for context. Sort of the dawn of the modern environmental law era, 1970, we had the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. There have been great strides that have been made in addressing pollution and improving the environmental situation. those largely occurred, you know, for almost 40 years without significant environmental criminal enforcement. So if you think about smog in Los Angeles, you think of the Cuyahoga River, you think about a lot of the conditions that generated the push for environmental law, a lot of the activity that historically went on to address those occurred with very limited criminal enforcement. And that criminal enforcement was usually limited, very special circumstances, maybe something like midnight dumping. I think there's many people in the regulated community who feel that compliance with the environmental requirements should be the goal, right? That means focusing on the environment and not necessarily expanding the reach of heavy sanctions that come with criminal environmental enforcement. So, the EPA certainly expressed that view with their December 5, 2025 Enforcement First memo, which explains that compliance is the goal here. That's the guidepost they'll use in directing their enforcement activities. And many regulated parties and many with stellar compliance records are welcoming this reform. And, you know, there's several reasons. Criminal enforcement is a very powerful tool, and it needs to be used, obviously, with discretion. It shouldn't be casually employed. And, you could ask the question, what exactly does one achieve if you have criminal enforcement that has a stiff civil penalty does not achieve? Obviously, a company with hit with a large penalty, whether it's civil or criminal, would respond. And, one of the interesting things about the criminal enforcement program is you're not necessarily, quote, winning the war on drugs, close quote, based on how many people you arrest. The goal is environmental improvement. And unfortunately, the program historically has been in the situation where it has to report how many criminal cases, it's broad, et cetera. And the press obviously focuses sometimes on those statistics. And by focusing on the statistics, maybe the big picture about the improvement of the environment is sometimes lost. And so finally, I would also say, based on experience of many decades in this area, when you get compliance up front, that's almost always a superior choice compared to after the fact enforcement. So cleaning up after an environmental violation is almost always more costly. It is less effective than preventing violations in the first place. Clear policies, clear rules, without creative interpretations, coupled with, I think, civil enforcement, almost always achieves that enhanced compliance. And many times regulated parties, if they know what the law is, they will work pretty hard to comply. So I think that historical background, provides some sort of context as to why there's this push to reform. And as you mentioned, John, there are thousands of pages now. Tens of thousands of pages in the Code of Federal Regulations. And as the president's executive order mentioned, I mean, a person can't hope to know all these laws and regulations. And so it really is, and many of them are strict liability type situations. It makes sense, I think, to really reserve criminal enforcement for those special cases. And that's why you see this push for reform. Let me stop there. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about on this issue, and I'll pass it on to back to you, John.
Okay, great. Thanks, Grant. Justin, your thoughts?
Thanks, John, and thanks, Grant. I agree with Grant's remarks and John's opening remarks. Let me just add a little bit more context for a couple minutes, and then we'll start talking in depth about one of the issues, vehicle tampering or onboard diagnostic or OBD tampering. When these laws were... Our federal environmental laws really came to being, as Grant indicated, after the Cuyahoga River fire in Cleveland and some other seminal events in the 1970s. The U.S. was a dominant manufacturing force, which many of these environmental laws address manufacturing and some of the consequences and arising from that. So just looking at the statistics, in 1970, 19.7 million Americans worked a manufacturing job. In 2024, that was 12.9 million. That's a 35% decline. So manufacturing has gone more global. And then as Grant alluded to, the amount and volume of regulations has grown. So in 1970, looking at the statistics, there was about 54,000 pages in the Code of Federal Regulations. Today, it's about 190,000. So almost a fourfold increase And in the meantime, EPA, the statutes and EPA's apparatus is really still focused domestically. There is a large enforcement machine. You think about something like the FDA, which has authority under its statutes to regulate good manufacturing practices at pharmaceutical manufacturing around the world. EPA and DOJ and the environmental world are not really set up to do that. So a lot of the enforcement has been trained domestically. And as Grant alluded to, there can be statistics. This administration has been criticized, but they just came out with their fiscal year 2025 statistics. They look very robust. So we're how does environmental criminal enforcement fit into that? The problem, as I see it, is on the civil side, there are very draconian remedies, per day civil penalties. I believe, Grant, for a Clean Air Act, it's over $160,000 a day. The government can seek injunctive relief. There's some administrative authority, and it's a strict liability standard, meaning the fault is not necessarily a defense to a violation. It may, the relative culpability of a company may affect the amount of civil penalties. And then on the criminal side, again, it can be very draconian. The Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act, for example, have a negligence standard, and courts have ruled that it's a simple negligence standard. Now, that's for a misdemeanor. But also on the felony side, the Clean Air Act, RCRA, the Clean Water Act have a knowing standard. Common sense, you may think, well, knowing means that you were doing something wrong, that you knew this standard was out there and you violated it anyway. Unfortunately, the courts in the limited amount of appellate case law out there said knowledge just means you know the conduct is occurring. So it leads to situations where there's a large gray zone. I think Grant has dealt with this, John's dealt with that. Anyone who practices this area where you look at conduct and the statutes are so broadly worded without limiting features, there's some doctrines that can limit them, that you could have conduct that could be arguably a civil violation or the government could try to make it into a crime. So historically, the government has had factors that they've used to cut civil from criminal. They called the Devaney factors. The last administration had a memo. This administration has a memo. And really, the four factors that come up all the time are deceptive conduct. Is there lying, cheating, or stealing that gave rise to the violation? Is there harm? Is public health or environment harmed? In the recent executive orders out of this administration, that's been a key one. Is there repetitive violations, meaning have you had an administrative violation, a civil judicial violation, leading to consent decree, and you're just still not getting it? Is it continue to occur? And then you are completely operating outside the regulatory system. And a good example of that is the administration just indicted an incinerator company in Puerto Rico, which had a lapsed permit for an incinerator, and they continued to burn things without a permit. Now, one of the things we're going to talk about today, which I think was an abuse of prosecutorial discretion, with all due respect to our friends in the government, is a series of prosecutions, 42 cases that were brought for so-called vehicle tampering or tampering with a monitoring device. Under the Clean Air Act, there is a long-time felony prohibition from the 1977 amendments that say you cannot tamper with or remove a monitor required to be maintained. And at the time in the Congress passed this in 1977, that was intended for smokestacks. Makes sense. If you're going to have emission limits on smokestacks, we need to monitor, see what's going on. 30 years of enforcement on this. What happened, particularly in the last administration, but a little bit at the tail end of the first Trump term, was that some creative prosecutors and agents interpreted that monitoring provision to apply to onboard diagnostics in vehicles, which can monitor vehicle performance and emissions. And that was really put into place in the 1990 amendments. I think our position, and the administration has recognized it, is that those OBD monitors, your check engine light, are not monitors required to be maintained under the statute. You drive around with a check engine light on, it's not a felony. The second point here is there's a 1993 guidance that came out from EPA after the 1990 amendments that said, gee, we still wish we had criminal enforcement authority over vehicles. We don't have it. And what happened is because of this reinterpretation, which some clever lawyers in the government had, it led to a wave of 40 cases, many against small businesses, relatively unsophisticated individuals. That then came into this administration, and there was a few things that happened. First, Justice Gorsuch wrote a book. You should all read it. It's called Overruled. And it says there are 300,000 regulations in this country that have criminal penalties. The administration issued an executive order 14294, on fighting over criminalization of regulations, the compliance first memo, which Grant mentioned, and then finally, a post in social media and confirmed in filings in court, the administration on January 21, 2026 said that they are no longer going to go after folks criminally as a policy for tampering with your check engine light or your onboard diagnostic. And that particular issue, I think, a consensus issue in the defense bar. I know John Irving helped us. I think we talked to Grant at one point, Stacey Fletcher at Gibson Dunn, Stacey Mitchell at Akin Gump, Jonathan Martell and Arnold Porter, and Jeff Wood at Baker Botts. We all talked about this. I think there was a lot of engagement to try to make this right, and I think the administration had. I'll just say, final thought, there's more work to be done. As Grant said, these are powerful tools, and they should really be used sparingly and not as a first option. Thank you.
Thanks, Justin. I agree with everything you just said. Let's try to break it down a little bit. Let's start off with kind of an overview of, you know, overcriminalization more broadly, and what are the dangers of that? What are the, you know, what are the kinds of discretionary calls that the government has to make? You know, how do civil and criminal parallel investigations work? What are the dangers of overcriminalization? I'll leave it here, whoever wants to jump in on that.
Grant? Oh, you're still on mute.
John, I'll take a crack at that.
Okay.
I do think there's an issue when there's overcriminalization. And one of the issues is actually it slows sometimes the resolution, right, of, I think, very straightforward violations of a regulation where, you know, a party is realizing they're in violation, is potentially criminal. And then you get that whole criminal machinery going, right, with respect to a grand jury subpoena, et cetera, in parallel with a civil investigation. And you can understand why a company that's facing both a criminal and a civil investigation would be somewhat reticent, for example, to come in and have a discussion, a frank discussion with the civil side about, here are the issues, here's what we're doing to fix them, et cetera, when there's this parallel criminal enforcement going on. So that's a byproduct sometimes of this criminalization. It does make, I think, everyone's lawyers up. It's difficult to talk to people who might have been involved. There's a lot of issues here where if it was straightforward and it was an administrative or civil case, I think the company could get its arms around it much quicker. And I think the resolution would come a lot quicker. With respect to, you know, whether you need criminal enforcement, we talked about that a little bit. There are many, many cases where I think, you know, you look at some of the largest penalties that have come out of some of these settlements in the environmental area. They are huge penalties. There's often this feeling that in the environmental enforcement context, civil or criminal, penalties are much higher, for example, than, let's say, a workplace safety a violation, and there may not have been no fatality involved, et cetera. And yet on the environmental side, with no environment, no fatality involved, the company's ending up paying quite a bit more. And that whole posture of seeking enforcement as opposed to compliance, it leads to a lot of these odd situations. And I speak from experience, right? I was the assistant minister for enforcement. And I know that if you're in the enforcement machine, a lot of times there can be a tendency, and it's true. It's a natural process of becoming inured to that process. If every problem looks like a nail, as they say, then every problem can get addressed with a hammer. That's the issue, I think, with respect to, we have this machinery, we have this program that is all set up for enforcement, and particularly criminal enforcement. I think that's where you really have this tension between the genuine desire by the public to improve environmental conditions and companies trying to comply with thousands of pages of regulations, many of which are unclear, many of which are technology enforcing. And as Justin said, the sort of interpretation over time, right? There could be no change in the language, and yet the agency's interpretation over time may change. And what's a company to do, right? They're literally sitting in a situation where you would think the law is the law and there's no change in the law, I'm okay. But if the interpretation changes, are you suddenly therefore in jeopardy of criminal enforcement? And that's a really difficult thing for companies to deal with. You can combine that with a situation where, let's say, the policy changes administration to administration. That makes it even more difficult, right? Because you have more or less enforcement, more a different view of the actual statute, which oftentimes hasn't changed at all. For example, the Clean Air Act, right? We have had very few amendments. And yet I can definitely say that the views of people on what it takes to comply with the Clean Air Act, and certainly in the mobile source side, the vehicle and engine side, has changed over time. And yet, how is a company supposed to deal with that, especially smaller entities, right? They're not going to have a staff that can track all the changes, all the rule makings, all the guidance documents from the government. And so that's a real, real tension here. And I think the idea of some reform here, and particularly in the vehicle, especially an individual working on their own vehicle, I think that is really where, you get a situation where people feel uncomfortable a little bit with applying criminal enforcement and in that context. So I think, that's a great example. And Justin, that's a great example of where I think this reform has addressed an issue that really could have been, this issue of people tampering with the emission control systems. Mm-hmm. Typically could have been addressed civilly, right? I mean, if a person is making a money by tampering with other people's vehicles, the civil penalties are quite severe in the Clean Air Act. They can certainly claw back the government all the profits, the economic benefit that the person obtained from tampering with the onboard diagnostic system. But applying that criminal sanction to something that the government had one time said was not within their reach is really, I think, an example, and only one example of the type of situation that many companies face day to day. So anyway, those are some thoughts on that civil criminal parallel proceedings of how that criminalization can have a sort of a retarding effect on trying to resolve a lot of these issues.
Right.
And there are, I was going to turn to you, Justin, and mention that, another thing in the mix, for example, is DOJ's, policy about going after individuals, right? I mean, if you are, faced with both criminal, potentially both civil and criminal sanctions for a given set of facts that might be able to satisfy either, and you're representing an individual that might be involved in it. That clearly has some implications. We have one question. What, if any, are the constitutional due process implications or other constitutional provisions for strict liability criminal environmental offenses? And I'll just kind of combine that, Justin, and turn to you. What's your experience been in these kinds of cases? And how would you approach a scenario that may or may not be criminal, before versus now? Have you seen a difference?
There's many questions there. I think those are great questions. As a general matter, as written on paper, there are no strict liability environmental crimes per se. There is something known as the responsible corporate officer doctrine or the Park doctrine, where in theory, in a highly regulated environment, this really grew out of food and drug, highly regulated environment, that you can have an executive charged. Now, it's written into the Clean Air Act for certain hazardous air pollutants that expose workers and there's injuries, but that is a very rare fact pattern. As a general matter, put aside the Park Doctrine and these provisions in the Clean Air Act, you have to have a intent, a mens rea. The problem is that the courts, the appellate courts, have interpreted knowing as just knowing that you're committing the conduct. So you can get in these really bizarre situations. Grant can probably talk to some, I know John, you can, where you're looking at this case and you really strongly feel it should be civil because people just made a mistake. And most of the time, everyone knows the enforcement funnel at the top, whether it's criminal or civil, is very broad and then it narrows. But the problem you've got is that companies spend a fortune defending these. Individuals may have to have their own counsel. And just working with individuals and even small businesses, this is incredibly stressful. We've had people have heart attacks, cancers, it besmirches their name. And then you get in this situation where the company may decide it's in the company's best interest to take a plea and cooperate. And that could involve providing evidence about employees. So I wholeheartedly agree with Grant that this needs to be reserved for the true scofflaw, the true willful company or individual who will not just comply. I think, unfortunately, what we see in this, they're doing a better job. I think more could be done. Is sometimes it's used as a option of first choice. And the vehicle cases are a good example that they would just open a file without some of the other incriminating or inculpatory evidence that you would normally see at the outset of a criminal case.
What have been some of the consequences for your client, for both of you, your clients? I mean, there's a point where the government's kind of, trying to squeeze blood from a rock. I mean, if you got $160,000 per day, civil penalties and, even potentially worse criminal penalties and, and the company only has so much money. I mean, what do you do with a situation where, it may or the facts may or may not be criminal, but the government's coming, trying to bury your client.
John, one of the things that often happens is you reach a point where the agency or the department says basically it's an ability to pay, right? I mean, basically they take a look at your finances and decide how much that company can pay. And because they obviously can't address the total maximum statutory penalty or the penalty that the government's demanding. And that's a very traumatic experience for some of these small businesses. It can put them out of business. Basically, it can take a company to within a hair above insolvency, right? Because it's a very, very, I think, strict test as far as what the company's ability to pay is. So that's a very difficult situation. And if I could harken back to your question of, I think Justin made a good point about many of these cases really do seem civil. Why are we in this criminal part of the enforcement program? That's one of the things I tried to address when I was the assistant administrator, because there was this feeling that sometimes a case, depending on who first became aware of the violation, if there were a criminal enforcement person or there were a civil enforcement person, they would go down these two separate paths, right? So you'd have very two different results, right? If the first person who found it happened to be a civil person and it proceeded that way for several years and or whatever, several months and was resolved, it would be resolved civilly. Conversely, if a criminal enforcement person had found the issue, it might be prosecuted criminally. And it seemed that basic, sort of luck of the draw situation should not be what determines whether a case is pursued or prosecuted civilly or criminally. Right. It should be based on the nature of the violation, the nature of the issue, the factual context there. And I think that they're trying to work on that. And I think that those type of policies help. But again, a lot of times, you can get these situations where we on the in the private bar say that really is a civil violation. As Justin said, that volitional act, it just needs to be you're volitionally doing something. You don't necessarily know, for example, right, that was going to cause an exceedance of some standard or something, right? It's volitional in the sense that you voluntarily conducted that act, right? But you didn't maybe not have known that was going to cause an environmental violation, or even that there was a regulation that was applicable to your behavior. And I think that's really an issue. I think constitutionally, as people say, it's a little bit in tension with what we typically think would be required for a criminal violation, and then maybe something that would get addressed in the right case, right? That might be something that could be addressed. But a lot of times in the sort of the day to day sort of business that Justin and I see, we're just faced with a situation. We're trying to resolve it. And so you don't get that litigated result, right? Nobody wants to take that chance and go and appeal a conviction, for example. They just rather resolve it as quickly as they can. And so you get these practices that develop over time. We talk about agency or administrative creep, but that sort of same sort of phenomena can occur with respect to the reach of the environmental laws. And, that's why I think reform is welcomed by many, many people in the regulated community.
Right. And I'll just add, the consequences of a civil case can be severe, billions in penalties, an intrusive consent decree that requires restructuring the business, quite severe. On the criminal side, it just adds another layer. So for a company, so if you are convicted or plea to a Clean Air Act crime, it can trigger suspension and debarment, meaning you can lose temporarily or permanently your ability to contract with the federal government. That can have a huge negative impact, not just on federal contracting, but a lot of states follow the SAM list. So you're in serious trouble there, unless you also negotiate that. And then for individuals, you take a plea to a felony, you lose your right to vote, you lose firearms, and then this is another area of reform. You can be debanked. And in some situations, I understand, and I'm speaking personally, someone's a serial fraudster, a Bernie Madoff, maybe not a good idea to have a bank account, but it can create for just individuals a nightmare of consequences. And the problem is, it is so costly and expensive. And Grant and John, you alluded to this, slow to get one of these out of the system with a declination. It can take years. And so what do you do in the meantime? And I'll just say, I think we need reform, not just for all the fairness reasons and legal reasons we identified, to compete globally with a global manufacturing landscape. We cannot just keep going after our companies, particularly when our laws are not amended to allow, like the FDA can, to pursue competitors. We have the situation all the time where the government goes after our client and says, we think there's a violation, civil, criminal, and our clients will point to other companies overseas where literally EPA will say, well, we're powerless. We think they're bringing it in. We don't understand how. And it creates this disparity where U.S. companies feel like they're getting pile driven, and then companies we're competing against overseas have the lightest touch, if any touch at all.
Okay, thank you both. There's another question about, how do you know that this isn't going to change if there's a new administration, right? I mean, we it seems that over the last decade or so, it's, when the Republicans come in, they say A, and then the Democrats come in and they say not A, B, and they, cancel each other's policy memos back and forth, and it's kind of like watching tennis. So now that we have this, this effort, how do you make sure that it's not going to change tomorrow? And what are the, a lot of these things have 5-year statutes of limitations. You might think you're okay now, but you might not be in 3 years. What do you think of, is there some way to make these changes more permanent?
John, I think you bring up a great point. I mean, there's a 5-year statute of limitations. Obviously, a president's term is 4 years. We obviously have seen dramatic changes in policy and not only, more broadly, but in the environmental area, right? And as you alluded to, there were a series of memos regarding what the Department of Justice's policy would be with environmental enforcement. And those were canceled, I think, right after the Biden administration came in, and then they were reinstated, many of them, right after the Trump administration started its second term here. So it is very difficult, I think. What is a company to do, right? And we see that in many, many aspects of the type of companies we deal with respect to competing, and as you mentioned, competing internationally, that's also another challenge. I think the issue that a lot of us see, though, is putting aside the competition and the lack of environmental regulation in many other countries, we just can address many of these environmental issues, right, through civil enforcement. Do we really need criminal enforcement? It is inefficient many times, right? It takes years to resolve these things. It's costly, as you mentioned. We can avoid that if we smartly, right, focus on compliance and work to, you can address a lot of these issues civilly. You can work, you know, at least domestically with respect to any economic benefit one competitor might have or another. The civil penalty policy of both Department of Justice and EPA claws back, right? Claws back any economic benefit from the violation. So I think that there is an ability to more efficiently run this train by simply focusing first and foremost on that civil side, right? That's the key, I think. But you do bring up a good point, Justin. These folks overseas, not subject to the same issues. We saw that when I was the assistant minister, there were a lot of products coming in from overseas that had bad substances, right? They had lead in them, and you had melamine in pet food. You had a lot of things coming in, right? And it's difficult and particularly hard, I think, for EPA to address a lot of these, especially when it's an import, right? We see that again and again. You even see it in the vehicle and engine space, right? So you see these engines that really don't meet our requirements, you know, some of them are just knockoffs of legitimate products. So it is a concern. But in general, for the domestic industry, I think civil enforcement really can be used effectively, and we can continue that environmental improvement with respect to the environment with I think clear regulations. And I think more compliance assistance as opposed to always going to the most heavy-handed criminal enforcement.
Yeah, and I 100% agree. And I also I think the calibrating enforcement affects not just competition overseas, but we want investment in our country. We want companies to come here and invest. We want to prosper together. And it's and Grant, you've done this many times. I've done it, John, you've done it. It's really hard to explain to a multinational why a mistake is putting them into a criminal investigation where engineers, executives could be in jeopardy. We've got to bring 7 other law firms in. It's just really hard. And we need to be able to have a reasonable criminal and civil justice system. And maybe we have criminal enforcement, environmental enforcement for the worst SCOTFA laws. But the way the system is now, I think it creates this weird asymmetry. As Grant said, it slows down civil enforcement. It makes it harder to compete. And then I think it makes it a little harder to attract investment because when you're talking through the pros and cons of coming here, we have a very aggressive legal system. I think people understand the civil side, but the criminal side, it just adds another dimension.
Okay. We've only got about 20 minutes here. So let's shift a little bit from kind of broader discussion of over-criminalization and environmental law generally to these tampering cases. Justin, can you give us, what are these cases? I mean, when we talk about OBDs and, you know, vehicle emissions tampering cases, what are we talking about?
Okay. So let's take a step back. Let's focus on cars and trucks, passenger cars and trucks. So under the Clean Air Act, when original equipment manufacturers, you know, your Ford Motor Companies of the world, when they sell into the United States market, you have to get what's called a certificate of conformity or a CERT in order to sell into the market each model year. Under the Clean Air Act, that means you have to have emissions controls. So for like a gas vehicle, it would be a catalytic converter. For a diesel vehicle, it would be a diesel particulate filter and a selective catalytic reduction. But part of that configuration of having an emission control system, Congress said, we want you to have a monitor. So in case there's a malfunction in your catalytic converter or your SCR, your DPF on the diesel side, the customer brings it into the shop. So Congress in 1990 enacted section 205, I think it's 205M, to say you need to have an onboard diagnostic system. EPA quickly said, let's let California do that. So every year when Ford Motor Company or whatever company comes forward with a certificate to get into the market, they've got to have an OBD approval. My monitors work and my emission control system works. The asymmetry here is that everyone agrees, everyone, the government, we litigated this several times. They say if you rip out the emission control system, so if you took out your catalytic converter, you know, if I went to a shop, Grant and I said, you know what, cool, we're going to take out our cats. That's a civil violation. There's penalties, injunctive relief, that's civil. But the government's position is, well, if you disable your check engine light, your onboard diagnostic, that's a crime. And the weird asymmetry, I'm not getting into all the details, is that around 2018, the government started saying, wait a second, in the Clean Air Act, this old provision, section 113C2C, says if you tamper with a monitor, it's a felony. And as I said, in 1977, that meant a smokestack. And the government's position is, but wait a second, it says any monitor. In 1990, Congress said that onboard diagnostic is a monitor. Plain language, sorry, defendant, you lose. You should have recognized that onboard diagnostic is a monitor. The problem I think the government has is the language in the statute is it's not a felony to tamper with any monitor. It's a felony to tamper with any monitor required to be maintained. Makes sense if you own a factory, you have to maintain that monitor on smokestack. Not so much with a vehicle. You know, there's not a legal duty on the part, I think, of owners or people in shops to maintain those monitors. So I think that's where the disconnect comes from. And there was a 1993 guidance right after the 1990 amendments. And Grant's former partner, I think Stuart Drake at Kirkland, was involved in some of those amendments. A lot of people, David Buente here, no one really thought that the Title II of the Clean Air Act governing vehicles and mobile sources had criminal enforcement. No one thought that. And in 93, EPA issued a memo saying, it's been a couple of years, we're looking at this, what are our gaps, what can we do? And they concluded in the memo, an internal memo, we don't really have criminal enforcement authority. So to me, this is a creative reinterpretation of the statute by clever lawyers in the government, starting in really 2018, but it took off in the last administration where, we had 42 cases, many targeting small businesses, individuals. And that's where I think the unfairness is. It's one thing to say you shouldn't have been doing this, pay a large fine. And, you know, you have to go, you're going to be enjoined. It's another thing to say you're going to go to a federal correctional institute. Sometimes for real time, you're going to lose your right to vote, your right to firearm, maybe debanked because of an interpretation of the Clean Air Act that, frankly, a lot of people who practice the Clean Air Act were not aware of.
Okay. And Grant, so a lot of these, you know, cases that we're talking about now with the, you know, defeat devices and, you know, rolling coal on a pickup truck and that kind of thing really kind of had their, started with some of the cases that I think you had involvement in with, you know, large overseas manufacturers.
Yeah, no, I mean, clearly there's a concern when you're talking about a large manufacturer, right? That's what I think what Justin's talking about is the individual. And, you know, there's a very big difference between, let's say, a big industrial facility that has a permit, they have certain limits, they have monitors required to make sure they comply with those limits. And you have an individual owner or somebody who just has a garage or whatever. And you know, there's no permit respect to, you know, obviously that gets issued to you individually. And so your vehicle is just your vehicle. And so this, I think, use of Title I to address things in Title II is an issue. It's because Title I in the Clean Air Act deals with stationary sources in general. And in general, Title II is vehicles and engines. By pulling that over from Title I, you can see where it causes all kinds of mischief, right? So basically, you had this issue where I think, if you ask the general public, right, a regular person, can I change something on my car? It's their own vehicle, right? They would, you know, as soon as it's not a safety related thing, they'd say, yeah, why can't I change that? So there is clearly, I think, a cultural and other issues here, but legally, this change in position, it's not just these onboard diagnostic systems, right? I think the agency's views, as they get more experience, as technology changes, that their views change on a number of different technical details related to air pollution, emissions, whatever. And as their views change, that's where we get these situations where I think you have the potential for mischief, right? Where a person might have been thinking they're complying, and then the agency changed their mind over years. And maybe it's for good reason that they've developed more experience. But we need clear guidance. We need clear regulations. We need, you know, if people want to change what they think the Clean Air Act can or cannot do criminally, that's when you need, I think, a statutory change, right? You need a change in language so everybody understands. And that's what I think has been sort of a missing link here. We have this evolution in the technology, you have an evolution in the products that could be regulated by EPA and the Department of Justice, but you do not have changes. You know, we've had relatively static statutes over the years, and trying to adapt that language to this new situation. Again, it's a problem, and we see that recurring. But anyway, let me stop there, John. I know we're almost out of time here.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add is the level of zeal in environmental criminal enforcement is like a gun case or a terrorist case. So we've had many cases in the aftermarket where the first touch point with EPA is literally a raid at 6 a.m. with agents, weapons at the ready, at people's family homes. There was a case, United States versus John Long against an enlisted sailor. That was a fact pattern. And then we've had the opposite fact pattern where companies have said they're in the civil enforcement system, and literally the general counsel will fly to regional office EPA, say, what can I sell? What can I not sell? EPA won't tell them. And then there's an FBI raid. So, you know, to Grant's earlier point, our point, John, your point, all of our thinking, this just needs to be calibrated in an appropriate way for a lot of policy reasons.
Yeah, and some of these cases are complicated factually too, right? I mean, it's one thing to go cut a catalytic converter off, and it's another to, you know, download a, you know, a tune to change the engine codes from, you know, who was it that who created it, who, you know, what is that exactly does it change in the engine? I mean, you know, a lot of people just think they stick something into their, you know, OBD, the car diagnostic port, and you know, next thing they know, they're felons. Any connection between DOJ, EPA's kind of rethinking of how they want to approach these cases and EPA's endangerment finding, or some of the recent, you know, concern about the California Air Resources Board being the, you know, driving force behind, you know, emissions controls?
Well, let me just say this. I think it's interesting, as Justin mentioned, you really have California a lot of times as the primary certifier or reviewer, right, of onboard diagnostic systems, as opposed to the EPA. Same thing for other aspects, right? You can get an executive order or a certificate. I guess it's called an EO in California, right? If you want to sell an aftermarket part, and the federal government's not really participating in that. So it's kind of an interesting situation where over time, California has taken the lead in many of these areas that relate to emissions, right? Again, you see a parallel sort of reform going on right there with the federal government now, I think, reasserting its role. And we'll see, you know, whether that continues, but certainly there's a lot of litigation related to that. But again, you see this tension, right, between you have different regulators oftentimes looking at the same language, California, federal government, and might have different views. So you can see it's really difficult for our clients to really, I think, navigate that and comply. And when you put the overlay of criminal enforcement, I think it becomes particularly difficult.
Okay. We got a couple more questions here. This actually popped in my head too. Do you think that the 2027 implementation of a kill switch for driver impairment in all vehicles will result in a wave of tampering to remove them and then government prosecutions? Crossed my mind too. Right? Like, you know, you get in the car and the cameras, you know, decided that you look angry or mad or something and your car won't start. So,
yeah. I mean, look, I don't know that that's going to happen. There is in the federal Vehicle Safety Act. In the Safety Act, there is a parallel provision that you cannot tamper with motor vehicle safety equipment that is necessary to comply with a federal motor vehicle safety standard. So I don't know if the kill switch is part of that or it's emissions thing. I think right now, you know, the vehicle tampering guidance, as you pointed out, there's a question. It's a policy. So there's a statute of limitations on conduct. It's generally 5 years, as Grant mentioned, can be extended for conspiracies from, I think it's 5 years from the last overt act. So this is all very much up there. I'm skeptical that those would lead to a wave of cases. But the problem is you can't predict based on the policy, the conduct that you'll see out in the field. So maybe there is some scenario under which that could occur. I just, you know, we urge our clients to exercise caution. I think there's a lot of zeitgeist and enthusiasm over some of these reforms. But, you know, you all have already hit on the key question. How durable is this, especially when in our federalist system, you have not just the state, you know, not just the federal government, but as Grant mentioned, the state has its own authorities. And in some cases, you know, there's local prosecutorial authority. So I think caution is the buzzword there.
I think this is all giving me more justification for why I need to go buy a 68 Mustang.
We love our pre-emissions vehicles.
All right. And then just kind of a broader question that we received about, you know, so if Congress if only Congress can create laws, how is it that all of these, you know, regulatory crimes are constitutional? I mean, it's the statutes themselves, but, you know, say that, you know, violations of the regulations under this, you know, under the statute are crimes, right?
So. Well, I think it goes back to that volitional act, right? I mean, as Justin mentioned, the appellate case law has found that if you have a volitional act, the actor doesn't necessarily need to know that their act is causing a violation. What they need to know is, did they do this volitional act? You can talk about, is that something that eventually we get challenged? But there is case law like that out there. So to the extent that there's a question of constitutionality, to the extent it has been litigated, I think that issue's out there. It might be something for the right legal foundation to take on, right? That has not been, you know, if in our day-to-day work, that has not been an avenue that we've had the opportunity to pursue.
Yeah. And look, let's be real. There are some doctrines like the rule of lenity that are supposed to result in an ambiguous criminal statutes being interpreted in favor of the defendant. But these cases are litigated out in our U.S. attorney's offices. I think, you know, there's a lot of media now about the relationship between judges and federal prosecutors, but still, you know, federal judges generally trust federal prosecutors. They use heavy docket in some jurisdictions of guns, drugs, terrorism, you know, just the worst financial crimes. And so if you're out in one of those districts, it's tough if the same prosecutor standing up and say, Your Honor, this is a federal crime. And then you have to walk them through and say, well, Title I or Title II. I mean, it's sort of... It can go over the audience's head very quickly, even though as someone who practices in this area, you know, wait a second, this was not a crime. They literally just started this. And once these kind of cases get ahead of steam, it's a little bit of copycatism. People are, you know, EPA has a game plan. They go out to the districts. They say, we're pursuing these kind of cases. And you just see more and more, which is how we ended up with like a few in the first of President Trump to 42.
What do you say to the argument that, you know, the Trump administration is just ignoring environmental laws? You know, people can just ignore emissions controls and do whatever they want now. You know, enforcement is dead. What are your responses to those arguments?
I think they're wrong, first of all. I think that there are many, many civil remedies, very severe civil penalties, right? I mean, the civil penalties for tampering with a single vehicle can be, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, and it gets adjusted for inflation and keeps going up, right? So we're talking about, you know, and the civil process actually can be much quicker. So I think that there is a lot of activity. I just think that the shift from criminal to civil doesn't necessarily handicap the agency. It just uses a different, you know, different tool to get compliance, one that arguably is faster, more efficient, and could conceivably produce, I think, more effective results.
Yeah, I'll echo what Grant said. We were very busy last year. We're really busy this year. There's a number of civil cases that have been initiated. And then there's a fair number of criminal cases. Some, respectfully, I do not think should have been opened because there's no indicia of criminal conduct. But be that as it may, I would say that the atmospherics that the Trump administration is doing, oh, they're doing nothing enforcement, that is 100% wrong. And as counselors, we see that because sometimes people at companies, you know, say, oh, well, why is this happening? They're not enforcing. They're enforcing. And the people they have in place at a leadership level and a career level, you can agree or disagree. They're serious, smart people. So, you know, for those wondering, no, that's a complete myth. They are continuing to enforce. And I think the same thing happened with, you know, your former colleague and our friend, Susan Bodine, in the first term, John, is people said they're not doing anything. And then not only the numbers, but the case results told a different story.
Right. Okay, well, thank you both. I mean, any closing thoughts?
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It was an interesting panel, and I hope it was helpful to those in the audience.
Great.
Yeah, I echo those sentiments. Thank you both, John and Grant, of course, Libby, and for those in the audience for a great conversation.
That's great, and thank you both. Very much appreciated. I guess that'll do it for today's presentation, and I'll turn it back over to Libby at the Federalist Society.
Wonderful. Well, I'm going to echo all that for the fourth time and say thank you all so much for presenting on today's program, for sharing your expertise and opinions on a really important topic. Thank you to John, of course, for moderating. If our audience is interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society, please visit our website. That is fedsoc.org, fedsoc.org, or please feel free to send us your feedback at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. We always love to hear from you. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.